The 100 Years' War, the Duguesclin period, plans for 1383 campaigns. Well, this is going to be a little bit of everything. Now, towards the end of September 1382, the French court left Paris and traveled south towards Orléans, the assembly point for the army of Aquitaine. At about the same time, they began to receive reports of intense diplomatic activity in England and Flanders. Louis de Mauls had his agents among the Flemish community in London. Some, at least, of the Flemings' discussions with the English agents had occurred in Bruges, a porous international town where few things remained secret for long. At Montargis, the pleasure palace for Charles V, east of Orléans, the king's council met to consider the implication of these reports. In some ways, the debate mirrored the one that had occurred at Westminster 3 months before. The Duke of Burgundy, who had hitherto been obliged to go along with the council's southern strategy, was now seriously on alarm for his wife's inheritance in Flanders. He pleaded for French intervention in the county to support Louis de Mauls. He urged on those present the principle that a lord should support his vassal. To those who recalled Louis's past disloyalties, he replied that the count was ready to make amends and serve the king as he ought. His audience remained skeptical and reluctant to change plans so late in the day. For the moment, the duke was overborne by the consensus around him. The council believed that the best course was to send a commission of counselors into Flanders to try and offer terms to the men of Ghent and the broker a settlement with Louis de Mauls. The muster at Orléans was postponed until the situation became clearer, but the king's advisers resolved firmly, according to the most authoritative report, to go ahead with their original plan to attack the English in the southwest. When Parliament assembled at Westminster on October the 8th, 1382, the opening address was delivered by the new chancellor, Bishop Bray Brooke of London. Bray Brooke was a convenient placeman with none of his predecessors' preliminary parliamentary skills. His lackluster performance was evidently regarded as falling well short of the occasion, for it was followed by a fiery oration in the Whitehall by John Gilbert, Bishop of Hereford. Gilbert said he had never seen England in so much danger from its enemies. Without vigorous measures, the kingdom was on the point of being conquered and left at the mercy of its foes, and the nation and the landscape of England utterly destroyed. Two noble paths offered an escape from the perils around them, each blessed by the Pope with the indulgences of a crusade. The path of Flanders, proposed by the Bishop of Norwich, was a fine and broad avenue into France, offering the chance to inflict grave damage on the enemy in alliance with the Flemish towns, provided that the effort could be sustained for long enough. The path of Portugal, on the other hand, offered the prospect of ending the war altogether by forcing England's enemies to battle and putting John of Gaunt on the Castilian throne. There was no better way to bring the issue with France to a decision. The Duke, according to Gilbert, was ready to take an army of 2,000 men-at-arms and 2,000 archers to Spain. The cost would come to £43,000, assuming that double rates were paid to the men and that the campaign lasted 6 months. The sum, Gilbert proposed, would initially be raised from taxation, but provided that Gaunt survived it, would all be repaid in due course from his assets in England. The very fact that such a debate was occurring was symptomatic of the paralysis of the king's council. There was no precedent for a major strategic decision of this kind being laid before both houses of Parliament. The outcome was deadlock. In the Lords' views, John of Gaunt prevailed. Peers advised that an army of 4,000 men wasn't large enough, but accepted the argument that the path of Portugal could decide the war with France. They also thought it was essential to go to the aid of the Earl of Cambridge. They obviously had an altogether unrealistic idea of Cambridge's situation. The Commons took a different view. With some trepidation, remembering the rebellion of 1381, they voted a subsidy of 1/10 and 15/15, suggesting ways of reducing the share of the burden by the peasantry. Although they did not restrict the use of the funds, they made it clear they preferred the path of Flanders. The autonomy of Flanders, they said, was an essential interest of England. It was also easier to support by force of arms. An expeditionary army would have a shorter sea passage. The draw of the crusading indulgence would be a powerful aid of recruitment amongst Englishmen and foreigners alike. It would be a great deal cheaper. Finally, there would be indirect benefits from other fronts. An English invasion of Flanders would force the French government to cancel its plans to invade Gascony and deter them from providing military assistance to Castile. the commons were shrewder in their assessment of the strategic position than the lords, but neither assembly had reckoned with the speed of the French reaction. In the first few days of October 1382, the commissioners whom the royal council had appointed to reason with the Flemings arrived in Tournai on the March of Flanders. It was an impressive group, led by Miles d'Ormonde, counselor of France, Arnaud Courbet, first president of the parliament. From Tournai, they addressed letters to the three great towns, asking for safe conducts. They had come, they said, on behalf of the king to make peace between the Flemings and their count, and to discover whether there was any substance in the rumors that they were negotiating an alliance with England. They forwarded a conciliatory letter from Charles VI. Philip van Artevelde received this missive when he was in Ghent. He traveled to Oudenaarde, where the siege was now entering its fifth month, to consult with the captains of the Flemish army. Together, they committed themselves to the course that would lead them to disaster. They didn't recognize the olive branch for what it was. They seemed to have realized that an outright rejection risked provoking a French invasion, but they were overconfident in the ability of the great horde of men gathered outside of Oudenaarde to resist. They persuaded themselves that the English, who were in fact deeply divided on the merits of a Flemish alliance, were so desperate for access to the Flemish market that they would send an expeditionary force to Flanders on any terms. They also believed that they had more time than they really did. Philip van Artevelde wrote to the French commissioners from Ghent that he would not negotiate with them unless they first procured the surrender of the count's garrison at Oudenaarde and Dendermonde and reopened the River Scheldt to navigation. The commissioners replied with incredulity that they were only seeking safe conduct to discuss such matters. But Philip repeated his refusal, quote, "Believe us when we say that we mean it," end of quote. Van Artevelde wrote to them on October the 14th, "For although we are poor and humble men, we know how to speak like princes." On the same day, the Flemish delegation, which was to seal articles of agreement in England, received its instructions. Philip showed no sign of realizing that he depended for survival on English support. The delegates were instructed to offer the English a military alliance on land and sea, but only on exacting terms. Among other things, they were required the extradition of all exiles who had fled to England from the revolutionary governments of the towns. They were to insist on the removal of English wool staple from Calais to Bruges for 3 years, and thereafter a place appointed by Ghent. Finally, they were to demand the repayment of no less than £140,000, which the Flemish towns were believed to have lent Edward III in 1340, in the time of Philip's father. Power had evidently gone to Philip's head. 3 days after receiving this document, on October the 17th, 1382, the Flemish delegates left for England. So we've got a mess going on. Are the Flemish going to get help? What's France going to do? What's England going to do? Well, we'll see what happens next time. Now, the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.